Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Hey, listeners, Kevin and I need your help.
Yes, we need your help. Please, please, please. We need your stars. We need your reviews, you guys, on iTunes so we can start to climb those iTunes rating charts.
It's simple. Open iTunes, click on the iTunes store, search for Behind the Curtain, Broadway's Living Legends.
Then click on ratings and reviews. Under the customer reviews, click write a review. Then let us know what you think from 1 to 5 stars.
If you need some help, think of 1 star being Carol Channing and Paul Lynn in the Road Company of the last 5 years, and 5 stars being free front row tickets to Hamilton. Although, when you think about it, I actually would give 5 stars to the Road Company of Carol Channing and Paul Lynn in the last 5 years, because I think that would be awesome.
I would love to hear, can I hear Moving Too Fast as Paul? that's the one I really want.
She's a chick's the goddess. Been through Erica Schwartz and Danica Weiss and the Handelman twins.
So there you go. You can also leave a comment if you like.
That's it. That's
your reviews.
It.
Send us
Thank
your
you.
Reviews, friends.
Please. Hi, I'm Rob Schneider.
And I'm Kevin David Thomas.
And this is Behind the Curtain, Broadway's Living Legends. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter, @BroadwayCurtain, and make sure to join our Facebook page, Behind the Curtain, Broadway's Living Legends.
And follow us on Instagram, @BroadwayCurtainPodcast. Plus, you can always listen to our podcasts on Broadway World.
Huzzah for us. Our guest this week is truly part of a musical theater dynasty. His dad was in the original productions of South Pacific and Bells Are Ringing. His mother was in the original productions of Mr. President and I Had a Ball.
Oh, yes. Carrying on in that fine role and tradition, their son's credits include Follies, Titanic, and Thoroughly Modern Millie, among many others, including a stint on All My Children as Jason Sheffield.
My mom still asks about that. To tell us what it was like to grow up in a house full of legends, how he found love on the Titanic, and what it's like to be both the boy and El Gallo in the Fantastics, here is the delightful Richard Roland.
Welcome.
Thank you. Sometimes in the same show.
Well,
sometimes
the same performance. God! Rich, we are so happy you're with us today.
Thank you.
Let's start with your parents, if that's okay. We'll start there.
Great.
Tell us about mom and dad and what they did.
Let's see. Dad grew up in a very musical family himself. In fact, I'm actually third generation Broadway. My grandfather played in the pit, he was trumpet player in the pit for the 48 revival of Connecticut Yankee and King Arthur's Court.
Oh my God.
Wow.
So I'm actually third generation. And
that's amazing.
I always forget about that because we always look to the performers and we forget that there are beautiful musicians
down there.
Oh yeah.
And so the legacy just got longer, I guess. but dad grew up singing in church choirs as a kid. His mother was a well-known choir director, president of Nats at one point. Mm-hmm. He ended up landing his first Broadway audition, which was replacing Thomas O'Brien, is that right, in South Pacific.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, just one of the sailors. But,
yeah, totally.
You know, but Richard Rodgers loved him because he sang everything on the page the way it was written.
Imagine that.
Well, that's a novel concept today, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah.
So that was dad.
That was dad.
Wow.
And then what about mom?
Mom grew up as an army brat all over the country. Her dad was a colonel in the army during the Second World War, and she was born in Hawaii, raised on army posts in Colorado, San Francisco, all over the place, and was a music major in college. And I think the degree in her hand was still wet from the ink, and she was on a train to New York because she just wanted to get here really fast. Mm-hmm. And within that year, she booked her first Broadway show.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. And what years were this?
This is 57 or 58 for my mom. So she graduated in 57. I think Keene was her first Broadway show, and that was in 58, I believe.
Keene.
With Alfred Drake?
With Alfred Drake.
Is it one of your favorites?
Oh, it's a fantastic score. Sweet Danger.
Oh,
yeah, it's
Sweet Danger, Sweet Danger. It's so good.
It's one of those that I really want to see what went wrong with the book.
Yeah.
Because I shouldn't have said that. But
No.
It's a Forrest and Wright, the Kismet.
The Kismet folks, right?
Clown.
Yes. Hotel,
yeah.
Too?
Yeah.
Did they do some Grand Hotel at some point?
Yeah,
okay.
So here's the interesting part is that my mother worked with the original Curly from Oklahoma, and I finally got to work with the original Laurie in Oklahoma in the Follies revival. So
when you were young Ben in the Follies revival... Mm-hmm. You worked with
Joan Roberts.
Joan Roberts.
She was, you're going to shoot me for not remembering the character's name. The operetta.
Heidi.
Yes, Heidi. Thank you.
Wow.
Thank you.
Good job, Rob.
Thank you.
Where'd you pull that?
You know, I just...
Jeez.
It's so sad up here.
I was like, Lori?
Lori. No, not Lori. Lori.
He actually... Heidi. Rob Schneider actually is the IBDB database. It's just they just plug into his head.
It's true. He just gets requests and sends them right back out at you.
He just thinks the updates and they happen.
Exactly.
It's Heidi. trying
you.
To process it in a normal voice. Oh, and then your mom then got to work with Alfred Drake and Keen.
Yes.
Oh, no, I have to ask you, growing up, did your parents share any memories and anecdotes about working in the golden age?
Yeah.
Truly, I mean, the American musical theater. How cool is that?
Yeah, they sort of dovetailed on that, you know, they literally left Broadway, I guess. You know, I tend not to signify the end of the golden age with a specific date or show, but their last show was in 65. And they 64, 65.
I had a
Rob,
ball.
I had a ball.
Yeah, I had 64, a ball with 64, I think.
64, that's right. Yeah. But it had a nice long run into 65. And they both left at the same time. Dad wanted to go into commercial work, which was really booming for him at the time. And Mom wanted to concentrate more on singing and at that point just being a mother. And I came along a couple years later.
Wow.
When you were growing up, did you have a lot of, you know, celebrities coming to the house or dropping over, or Broadway folk?
There were some, like Harry Gause and his wife Maggie. Harry was holds the record for being the longest running Tevye.
Oh wow!
Or at least for a time he was. I think he was in the Guinness Book of World Records. His costume hung in the Smithsonian because he played it the most.
Oh my gosh!
So they were Mom's and Mom and Dad's best friends. They were also Mom's roommates for a while back in the day, but. So, yeah, we always had musical people over. We were going over to their houses. I wouldn't call it a star-studded event, but I do remember the time that we had a country house upstate in Warwick, New York, and there was one time that Richard Kiley came riding up on his horse because he happened to be...
Of course he did.
Of course, riding through the neighborhood, and he had Dad and Mom
horse.
Had done I Had a Ball Together. So
yeah, of course.
But, you know, it was fun. We had fun people over, and it was a chance for us as kids to see... that fun performer side of my parents, because we didn't see it that much. We saw the Mom and Dad who were now Mom and Dad, and
right.
I would go with Dad on his he was voiceover king for years, so I'd go to the studio with him on certain days when I didn't have school because I loved that world. But that's also where I got to see some fun kooky people. And you know, as you wait in a waiting room for any audition, you see, you know, 30 people from Broadway hanging around.
Right.
So
yeah.
I did grow up with these people. So that was fun.
And just really, really quickly, if our listeners want to look up your folks, Dad's name was?
Steve Rowland.
And Mom's?
Lispet Nelson, Lispet Nelson, Nelson.
Cool.
That's how she's listed on IBDB.
Cool. We'll
post a link. Yeah. So now they met doing I Had a Ball. Is
yes.
that correct? So out of that horrible flop, apparently, came something...
No!
What?
Horrible.
Well, it was a horrible flop commercially, but not
True.
Necessarily... No, the score is great.
Yeah, I love
it's a great
the score.
And yes. The script is what it is.
The script, yes.
Well, when we interviewed Karen, I feel like I remember editing it, and we were like, so Karen, can you tell us the plot of I Had a Ball? And Karen Morrow was like the lead in it, you guys. And she was like, well, there was Buddy Hackett. And like she couldn't yeah. like you. God bless
there
her,
was
love
a
you,
story.
Karen. But yeah, and she's like, but the score is amazing. And the score, actually, I do like the score a lot.
It's so fun. That, it's a great.
It's
I mean,
a silly
and
score
with her,
fun.
You know, brassing out with that voice.
Oh my gosh!
The funny part is, have you ever seen the Ed Sullivan clip of
yes,
the
yeah.
title number? Fantastic! It's so good that's preserved. What? Here's the structure of the show. What she's literally singing about my father's character in that number. That they're engaged. They're going to be married. They're going to have this thing. Well, my dad played among they were all crooks and con men in the show. That's sort of what it's about. And literally, somebody comes on stage. I can't remember which character. It might have been Richard Kiley's character. Comes on stage and says, I've lost her name now. The character's name, Karen Morrow's character.
That I don't remember. But we'll say Heidi for the record.
Let's say
That'll
Heidi.
Be...
He says Heidi Brooks. That's my dad's character's name. Brooks has fled town. He's taken the money and run. So the big number has just finished. About how good life is, she literally turns to center stage and sings the sad song of the show.
Really pace themselves there.
Yeah, they
really,
you know,
good.
They didn't leave that audience sitting too long. But I have the script, and it does. It reads like it sort of reads like it's a mad, 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 mad world. It's one yeah. of those 1960s sort of madcap, weird.
Well, if you listen to our interview with her, what was she saying? That there was a scene where they went through a tunnel of love.
Yeah.
And there'd be a blackout, and then the lights would come up, and there'd be a celebrity sitting in the car next to her. They would get guest celebrities to come in.
Yeah.
Very 60s variety show.
Very
yeah. Boy, I wish they would bring those back.
I know. I kind of, well, maybe, you know, when they were doing this last Hello, Dolly! In 94, I had a lot of friends in that. They would auction off someone to come in on the on the parade cameos. Sequence and cameo.
Oh, wow.
And I thought, what a great way to do that with celebrities. Just like, you know, I remember, oh, you can't take it with you. Was that it? No, Arsenic and Old Lace. Sorry, I've got my plays mixed up.
No,
that revival, I want to say the late 80s.
With Gene Stapleton.
All of the dead men would come upstairs from at the curtain call, and it was always a bunch of celebrities. Or
oh, that's funny.
I've never heard that. That's
the entire
hysterical.
Mayor's cabinet came upstairs. It was.
That's a brilliant. Genius. I'm going to steal that because that's so brilliant. Okay, so they met there, watching your parents in the auditioning process and stuff in the 60s and stuff, and then you getting into it a few years later. What are the major differences that you see from how they would book work as opposed to how, let's say, you book work?
I don't know. There are times I feel like when they talked about their audition processes, it sometimes sounded like it was 20 times easier to get a job in the 50s and 60s as it was when I was first starting in the late 80s, early 90s. Mm-hmm. But then again, you know, my mother talks about her first audition coming to New York in 1959. No, she came here in 58. Her first audition was auditioning for a replacement in Gypsy or something for the tour or something.
Wow.
Now, Gypsy was 59, so she wouldn't have auditioned in 58. Then she lied. No, she twisted your ears up like I always do. So anyway, her second or first big audition in New York is for Gypsy.
Wow.
And she's standing on the stage of the Broadway theater, because back then everybody auditioned in the theater no matter what.
Yeah.
And one of the assistants, I think it was Robin's assistant, circled her the entire time she was singing her song on stage, just sizing her up, looking her up and down. I mean, it was for Gypsy. I mean, you know, they had to, at one point, appear quote-unquote naked at the end of the show on the Christmas tree. So,
can you imagine you're singing your audition song and there's just a strange
man someone walking around you on stage?
I mean, we already, as an actor, I already felt like they were doing that anyway, you know, because auditions are so abysmal and terrifying. It doesn't matter how good you are at them. You still think they're just...
Oh, gosh.
They're X-raying me. I always felt safer at airports than I did in auditions. But I feel like the stakes are higher now. I sometimes want to say there are fewer jobs, but you know every theater in town has a show in it right now. So
yeah,
I might be exaggerating, but I just feel like I think there are a lot of similarities, a lot of differences. I had the chance back in the day when I was auditioning for Miss Saigon. We auditioned on the stage of the Broadway Theater.
Oh, wow.
And that was amazing. I mean, I still wrecked my voice, but, you know, singing Why God Why on that stage, even in an audition setting, was kind of a thrill. But you know, that never happens anymore. No,
and to
I
know,
don't,
also know that your mom, like, was on the same exact stage.
You know, I don't think I knew that story then either.
Oh,
but
man.
But at least we both auditioned on the stage of the Broadway Theater.
That's kind of wild.
That's really cool. We always ask this question, if you know the answer, that would be great. But if not, no worries. Which is, when your parents were auditioning, do you happen to remember if they had a go-to audition song?
I do. When my dad was auditioning for any R&H show, he had permission from Rogers to sing If I Loved You, because he was the only one, according to Dad and according to what Dad said about Richard Rogers, he was allowed to sing that at an audition. Rogers hated his material being sung at auditions, as most composers are not very comfortable with it, but he let Dad do it. So he went from, after doing South Pacific, his next audition was for Pipe Dream, and they had him come in and they let him sing, which kind of tells me in a way, like, Dad probably already had the job, but
yeah.
I mean, they liked him a lot. That he was easygoing and had this great voice and was always a good presence on stage. So they always knew they had a good cast member in Dad.
And Mom?
Ooh, what did she sing? You know, I came across a bunch of their old music recently, and she had, only because she did the revival in 1960, she had How Are Things in Glaucomora in her book. I don't know if that was her go-to, but she talks about singing that one for auditions.
What was the first Broadway show that you saw? You know, I'm sure you must have been steeped in it,
A child. It all comes back to Julie Stein and Stephen Sondheim, Gypsy, in 1974 with Angela Lansbury.
Oh, yeah.
And,
good one.
Dad had played me the album. It's all my dad's fault. He played me the album and was sort of hyping me up he said, do you want to be a newsboy? You'd be a great newsboy. And I had no idea what a newsboy was.
I love that he's like trying to get you into business.
Right,
like,
exactly.
Most parents are like, stay away.
Know. They neither dragged me nor repelled me from it. They sort of let me make my own choices. But I remember vividly driving back in from the country that Sunday. We were going to see it either that night or the next day or sometime that week. And he was singing half the score to me in the car, which was like, was my dad gay? I mean,
Gypsy.
I don't know. It was Gypsy, but it was their one of their favorite shows because here's another. My godfather, Dick Perry, was the trumpet player for in the pit for the original production of Gypsy.
So all those crazy high. He's very well known.
That's Dick Perry.
He's yeah.
That's Uncle Dick.
He's He's like one of the every time you hear an old the brassy show tune from that era. It's usually Dick Perry, playing all those high notes.
Dick was your uncle or
godfather?
Godfather.
Wow.
That's cool.
That's so cool.
So you also had this deep appreciation then not only for what happens on stage, but like you said earlier today, the beautiful people in the pit creating all that music. But
well, there's the pit. Uncle Dick's last show, he died in 89, ironically, just as the Tyne Daly revival of Gypsy was opening. He had really bad diabetes. I hung out with him in the pit at the Majestic Theater because that was his last Broadway show. It was 42nd Street.
Oh,
so
wow.
I got to hear Whatnot. I got to sit, I think it was Act One. I got to sit there and listen to all of Act One. But he was great. He loved my enthusiasm for the theater. He invited me to my dad to come to the original cast recording of 42nd Street at the old RCA Studios.
Mm-hmm.
So if you listen to the audition, Shadow Waltz, and I think We're in the Money, I'm in that room somewhere.
Doing the taps.
Doing the toe, picking up the taps. I can do this. I can do this. I got it. I understand the grind of it all. So when my dad would get serious and talk about why he finally left Broadway, it was sort of hard to hear, especially when I was younger and really wanted it.
Yeah.
And
did he make a conscious decision to? Oh, he did.
Yeah, yeah. I had during the 60s, he started to book a lot of on-camera commercial work, a ton of it, and it was a hard decision, but he really, and I think emotionally, I had a ball, took a stress on him. I think he also probably looked at his Broadway career up until that point as attached to Donna, and that he'd married my mother, and that was a new chapter. And at that point, they were both kind of, I think they were burnt out.
Right.
She'd gone from, they both went from show to show to show, and I think Dad did Bells Are Ringing for almost 3 years.
Wow.
Oh, my
gosh. So it was the entire run on Broadway. Then they took it out on the road. And when they offered him the film version, he just said, no, I can't do this show one more time.
Wow.
Came back to New York, and that's when he started getting roles. That was, Bells Are Ringing, he did a lot of smaller featured pieces. 110 in the Shade was the first time. Well, no, I'm sorry. He did a play in there as well. Come On Strong with Van Johnson was in the lead.
Oh, yeah.
Mildly successful run. But even Donna was in that with him. So he started getting roles. And then Noah was his first sort of breakout role in musicals, followed by Brooks in I Had a Ball. And I think that's when he just finally went, you know what? 8 times a week I'm doing this for, I don't know what Equity Minimum was in the 60s or even what his salary was at that point. But he was making in a day what he would make in 2-3 weeks on Broadway.
What were some of the commercials that he appeared in? Because he's a very familiar face.
They're all on my YouTube channel.
We'll
a lot of cigarette commercials. I shouldn't say all. He made thousands of commercials. I have a tape of about a CD. Wow. What generation am I?
No, it's okay.
I had a DVD of about 50 of them. And that just scratches the surface of all that he did. He became known as, did a lot of cigarette commercials. He did a lot of, he was always the bumbling but happy husband. He was never there are types. And I guess he would have been like the pre-Homer Simpson of commercials at the time. Sweet and lovable, but never the banker, never the lawyer, but just always the fix-it handyman.
Yeah.
Or he was see him in a lot of uniforms, like the Maytag man. But he never had that campaign. But
he appealed to working class America. He
very much so.
Blue collar.
In fact, if you go to YouTube.com, I'm Rich Roland. I think that's my username. There's a whole selection. You can also find me on Facebook. I'm not closed off. To the general
we'll
world.
We'll post the YouTube link.
I'll send you a link.
Yeah, that
I'll
send fantastic.
You a link. But there's some great stuff.
That's fun.
And that's when they used to do full on musicals as commercials.
Yeah.
They do My Heart Belongs to Allstate. About and they're dancing on cars and it's
classic. It's that's the old era of the industrials too, where
here's an interesting little
musicals.
Thing. I knew that my father had done a film with Madeline Kahn way back when, but it was an industrial film and nothing ever came of it. And he never talked much about it. He just talked about it was Madeline's first time in front of a camera and she was shy and kooky, but and this is 1966. I stumbled upon it on YouTube. I found it. It's called The Song of Arthur. It's out there.
The
it's on
Song
my
Song of Arthur.
written by Stan Freeman, who also wrote...
Oh, yeah, yeah. I had a ball.
Yep.
Yeah.
And it's for MetLife Insurance, I believe, but it's entirely sung. It's a musical about... It's like 30 minutes long.
Amazing.
Dad, as the, of course, the bumbling husband who wants to go on a diet, and Madeline Kahn plays his wife, and...
That's really cool.
Is this on your channel?
I think it is. If not, I think I have to call it, just so I'm not getting in trouble, I'm not calling it Song of Arthur, but I'm calling it, I might call it Dad's Industrial with Madeline Kahn, mm-hmm. I'm not sure. But there she is, with just being Madeline Kahn. And
we will post that. Now, do you remember other shows that you were seeing at this time besides Gypsy, which had such a massive effect on you?
The Magic Show also had a huge effect on me.
Oh, speaking of magic, yeah.
That was my...
Literally.
There were two LPs that played themselves, or I played to death in my room, and probably, now that I think about it, you know, those doors are so thin. They heard every... I could sing every song, play every character in both The Magic Show and Gypsy, and just those LPs were...
Boy, I have to say, though, it's not like you're like, Gypsy and Annie, get your gun, but it's like,
no,
The
clearly,
Magic Show.
I was well-rounded from an early age.
I love it.
I wasn't stuck in
great.
One genre.
Not Pippin. No.
No, Pippin came later. I discovered Pippin when I actually did it, and I went to French Woods, naturally.
Oh, nice, of course.
My parents had to get it out of me somehow, so... but I discovered Pippin there, and... By the way, Anne, Nathan, and I discovered that we were both in Pippin together at that camp, and I totally didn't know each other.
No, amazing,
not really.
That's funny. Oh my god!
I was a weird child. I kept myself very much. But there I was, Magic Show, Gypsy,
Magic Show. That's like, I want to be a lion tamer.
Oh, such a good score!
Right,
such a good score.
Style.
Like West End Avenue, West
Style.
I like
yes,
style.
With David Ogden Stiers.
Yes.
And wow. David
Cogsworth from Beauty and the
totally.
Beast.
And then I discovered A Chorus Line, and this is where my life sort of takes a little interesting turn. I discovered A Chorus Line and was introduced to the world of, even though I grew up in it, I always went to shows with my parents. So it was always an event. It was always the Actors Fund benefits. It was always or an opening night. But it was always in their care, in their umbrella, right. In their world. I discovered at 13 or 14 standing room.
Mm.
And that $10 was my gateway to anything I wanted to see. So I must have seen A Chorus Line about 40 times.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, with my allowance and whatnot, it was every Friday night or Saturday. I would just go down to the theater, plunk my bill down, and stand in the back of that theater. And that show, I was never going to be a dancer. That wasn't what, even though that choreography still, you know, I can still do it in my sleep.
Yeah.
But that was the life I wanted. I wanted to be one of those people. So at that age, I was discovering what show business could be on my own terms,
mm-hmm. Yeah,
instead of through my family's, because that was a show of my generation, not of theirs.
Where was college for you?
Denison University.
Yeah, you know. And were you doing musical theater specifically? Or
no,
theater?
They had a small theater, but they still have a small theater program. I got my BFA in theater there, theater performance. It was not specifically a musical theater department or program. There's a music department, a dance department, and a theater department. They all sort of had buildings next to each other down at the bottom of the hill where all the crazy artistic people were. And they would do a musical every few years, like every 4 years. They'd grab everybody together and do something. And then I was very lucky to come out of college and just start working.
Yeah.
So came to New York.
Yeah.
Did you have an agent?
I didn't at the time. I had a commercial agent.
Great.
I was chasing commercials as a teenager through William Morris and... CED, Cunningham, Ascot, Depeney, mm-hmm. And booking a few things here and there, nothing huge, nothing to put me through college, but just sort of having to have the experience of that. Because of my commercial auditions, I knew Judy Henderson really well, a casting director on the Upper West Side. Her office is, she might still be there, on 89th, I think, in West End Avenue. She has auditions in her home. It was always a very comfortable thing. And we went to see Forever Plaid at Steve McGraw's. And I looked at that show and I went, I have to do that. I have to be in that show. So a little 22-year-old me runs up to Judy Henderson and drops off my new picture and resume that I just posted one online. David Morgan, the headshot photographer. They're not bad. I like the way I look back then. I'd hire me. The time, I thought, you look at the pictures, you go, oh, my God, I'm fat. And I just ran up there with stuff for Judy, and she said, well, we're going to have auditions in a month for the San Diego premiere. Are you interested? And I was like, yeah. Yeah, I'll scrub toilets. I'll, and that's kind of what happened. I got hired to be the understudy to the original New York cast as they transferred out to San Diego for the first time.
First Broadway show that you were in.
I was a replacement in Scarlet Pimpernel.
So let's
version
1.0.
Oh,
And that's how I put it on my resume, too. That always got a nice chuckle from the from the table.
For those of our listeners out there, I mean, especially our younger ones, Scarlet Pimpernel is a Broadway musical that had, let's say, various incarnations, different versions of it, you might say.
It was it wasn't Cats, but it had 9 lives.
Yeah, yeah. It kept going. Yeah. They kept trying, that's for sure.
What's the closest thing now? What, Paramore or Spider-Man? No.
Well, Paramore, they did shut down to retool it again.
Yeah, so what exactly happened? So
praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com.
Well, you're a version 1.0.
So yeah,
you saw the original.
I came in very early. I was one of the first replacements. My friend Paul Castry was the swing for the show, and he booked, I can't remember what he booked. Anyway, he was leaving the show, and I got a call to go in, and here's why I got the show. I fit Paul's costumes.
Sometimes it's as simple as that,
you
folks.
Fit Paul's costumes, and that was your Broadway debut.
Well, let's just say Paul was 28-inch waist. I still think he is a 28-inch waist at this point. And, I mean, I'm looking at 36 now, but at the time I was 31, 32. I know I didn't fit those costumes, but they made... It was a great team. It was a great way to make a debut because you weren't carrying anything. You weren't responsible for anything except you were. You were responsible for all the little shit that had to get done during the show. Mm-hmm. You know, hold the gun here, run off, change back into the French lieutenant uniform, come out here, lift Christine Andreas off the bench on this count, run back. You're doing a split track today. You know, huge responsibility. But then I still wasn't even 30 yet. And it just was wide-eyed anticipation that I would wait for the call because, you know, I came into the show probably in its 5th or 6th month of the run. Mm. And at that point, vacations start happening. Mm-hmm. And I was on probably 4 out of every 8 shows on average.
You were swing?
I was a swing first, yeah.
So now, I don't know all that much about the Scarlet Pimpernel. So I have to ask you, why is there a 1.0? Why is there a 2.0? What exactly happened? They just closed the show down? And
they closed us in October, I think, of 98. And I left. I decided not to continue on. I had booked the Titanic National Tour at that point. And I didn't want to relearn a show only to do it for 2 weeks and then leave. What had happened was is that they closed the show down for a certain amount of time. They brought in a new director and choreographer to reshape the show. And they asked Nan Knighton, the book writer, and Frank Wildhorn, with Bobby Longbottom, who came in to retool it, rework it. And I mean, I mean, no disrespect to anybody, but I didn't think there was anything wrong with the show to begin with. I thought it was fun. It may have been more fun to do than it was to watch. I don't know. I thought the audiences loved it. We had our group of, you know, we called them pimpies, the groupies that came to see the show every weekend.
Pimpies.
Yeah.
Pimpies, yeah.
Jekyll and Hyde had them, too.
What were they called?
Jekkies.
Jekkies,
oh, my God.
Oh, yeah. Frank Waldron, he knows how to get his, fans.
But then did they have Drackies, or were those something else? For...
I don't know if it lasted long enough for anything there. Although I did see Dracula.
Sorry.
Did you really?
All of it. Oh, yes, and there was much to see.
I didn't see it. My husband's, one of his best friends was in it, I don't remember why I didn't get to see it. I might have been away.
Didn't last long enough?
It didn't last long, I know. But Scarlet Pimpernel did. It just kept coming back, and they kept reworking it. I don't know what they were trying to rework it for, to be honest. I'm not sure what the goal was. We sat in a couple of big company meetings where we all sat in the lobby and were told a bunch of information, which I'm sure at the time meant something, but I just remember sitting going, well, it's not that... It is what it is. It's a fun show. It's not that broken. But, and if I may, I don't care. I don't think it ever got better. I think it got shorter.
I think there's a consensus there. Yeah.
It got shorter.
More streamlined. There's different albums that have different songs in it. The tour was a little different.
Yep.
I think that went out. And so there was just different versions. And then they started seeing like version like 2.0.
Yeah. That's 3.0. I didn't know any of this stuff.
Yeah.
Like the AOL discs you used to get, like 1.0, 2.0, is that where
exactly.
It was?
Exactly. Well, this was the same time period.
Yep.
Jeez Louise, I did not know any of this. Okay, so you go through Scarlet Pimpernel, just 1.0. We don't make it to 2.0.
No.
Or negative 2.0, if we don't think it's an improvement. You go on to Titanic.
Yes.
The national tour. Now, what are you doing on this Titanic tour?
I saw that tour.
You saw it?
Oh, yeah. We came to Cleveland, maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We were there.
Oh, yeah.
It was cold.
Yeah,
it was winter in Cleveland. We, again, Julie Hughes and Barry Moss, I owe them so much gratitude for the start of my career on the Broadway level. Funny thing is they cast me in Pimpernel, and I sent them a bunch of flowers because they were the nicest people. And Barry called me. He said, "You didn't have to send flowers." I don't know why he sounds like Jimmy Durante to me, but "You didn't have to send flowers, kid. We'll get you something better." I just remember him saying that. And I was like, "Better? This is great. I'm so happy to be in this. You know, it's a great team." He goes, "We'll get you something better." Well, a few months later, I'd already gone through the rounds of auditions for the Broadway production of Titanic. So they knew me. The tour was opening up. I was one of the first people they called in. I went in and read opposite Jen Peach, who was playing Kate McGowan at the time on Broadway. Two things were happening. Clark Thorell was bumping up to Barrett on Broadway, and the tour was opening. And they sort of had this flip-flop discussion with me. Would you want to replace on Broadway, or would you want to originate on the tour? And I was looking at my bank account, and I went, you know what? I could sign away my life for a year and minimum and put the money away and originate something. I'd had the experience of replacing, and now it was time to create. And that's what I did. We started rehearsals at 890 Studios. And again, a great group of people, some of whom are starting to not be here with us anymore. Margo Skinner, for one, but Michael Schell recently. And Kevin Gray, oh my gosh.
Oh, yeah.
But that is where I had met my future husband, Raymond Sage.
Met. Showman.
How long were you on tour?
18 months.
Yeah, good. That's nice. Yeah. That's a nice long time.
Yeah. And after a while, even though, you know, you're living that sweet life, it's a sweet life. You have no responsibilities. And even though after a while it gets to you. And I think actually that planted the seeds where I was like, I can't. Eight shows a week is hard. It's really hard. I still stuck it out for a while after that. But I did. When we left the Titanic tour, I didn't do anything for at least 6 months. We came home in July of 2000, and I just took that time off and auditioned for a couple things, but didn't want anything. And blessedly, Follies just sort of fell in my lap, and that was the next thing.
So you were part of the first Follies revival.
Yes.
I mean, this is huge.
Wow, that was the first Follies revival.
Yeah. There was no middle ground on that one.
You either loved it or you hated it. And you were young Ben.
I was young Ben. I was the younger version of Gregory Harrison, which is the best compliment I've ever received in my life. My God. When I found out he was playing Ben, I was like, oh. It's like, surely they've miscast this. I have no idea what's happening. But so he's gorgeous.
So tell us, he is gorgeous. Now tell us about this production, because like you said, you either loved it or you hated it. Could you feel that when you're performing every night?
No. I only interacted with a certain amount of people in that show. I had the amazing younger team of Lauren Ward, Aaron Dilley, Joey Sorge. We were all the youngers.
Yeah.
Wow.
And so you have that team, and we worked very hard together and very well together. And even though Aaron left mid-run, I think she left to do the South Pacific tour, Kelly O'Hara replaced Aaron Dilley. So then I had a different Phyllis for the second half of the run in Kelly O'Hara.
That was her Broadway debut.
Was it really?
It was her Broadway debut.
I
did
not know that.
But they were all tremendous to work with. And then we spent, and this is why I love Matthew Warchus, we spent a few days in rehearsal, and not everybody's into this. It's not everybody's game as an actor or director. We got to do improv work.
So British.
With Judith Ivey and Treat Williams and Gregory Harrison and Blythe Danner.
Yeah.
And
just like 101, you know what I mean? Like back to basics in the best possible way.
So what would you improvise? Like what would you do? This is so
a lot of
foreign
story that's not told on stage.
Okay. Yeah.
You know, a lot of marital issues for the older couples. Mm-hmm. Aaron and I worked a lot on our dates as young Ben and you know, really playing upon the fact that Ben had no money. And then, of course, you know, figuring out how Sally and Ben started started playing around and how much Buddy knew about it, how much he chose not to see, you know. I don't know if any of that transferred to stage, and I don't really care, but we got to feel, and this is what I think Matthew was so brilliant at doing. He makes every single person in that room feel included. Mm. And I think in a show like Follies, it's so easy to say, okay, that's the ensemble. You don't matter. These are our four principals with a few older women around them that alleviate the stress for the evening. And that wasn't Matthew's point at all. That wasn't his vision at all. He wanted to make sure that everybody on that stage had a specific reason for being there and had a story for being there. It was good work. And it was hard because people came down hard on that show. They came down hard. And
They did.
I know it's a critic's job to do what they do, and Lord knows we leave theaters and sometimes just have the most horrible things to say about it, but it was the season where certain critics couldn't reference any other show in any other review for at least the next year without referencing Follies at the Belasco and how they felt about it,
right?
Particularly the negative ones. That was tough. That was really tough because, you know, like any show, you work hard and you realize you're working on a show about memory and how time perverts your memory and how you can't clearly remember how something happened. So the same thing happened with the show. There was this almost fantasy production that happened at the Winter Garden Theater, which now I have seen footage of. And yeah, it's pretty fantastic what happened there.
Yeah.
But there were people that were not willing to let the new version be what it was. And I still stand behind Kathleen and Matthew's vision for that piece.
It seems that you were starting to get the directing bite a little bit. I mean, well, had you always had a vision to be the director?
I had done enough productions where I knew how to appreciate the good direction that was happening around me, but also how to save myself from some of the less than constructive directing that was happening around me.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to name any names on that respect, but I had done some regional productions in between all this. Some were fantastic. Others were like, how do you even have a job? But, you know, it can be so upsetting sometimes when you miss wonderful opportunities and the actors are left to sort of make something there that's not, or that it's not their decision to make. And that it starts to creep up on you. I just started developing an eye for, I think it was Matthew that really started that ball rolling, just went how he handled a room of 40 something actors.
You know, of all scales of life.
All scales of life.
Old school showbiz.
Yeah.
I can't even imagine a show like Follies. You've got to navigate so many personalities.
And he and Kathleen knew where to put every long-legged ghost at every moment. You know, it was just beautifully done. So that probably was what sparked that. And then I still kicked around as an actor for a while. Left Broadway with a bang in Millie.
Yeah.
That was fun. And even that, I worked a bit with Michael Mayer on that because I was Susan Egan's first Jimmy when she replaced Sutton.
Right. So you were there with all of that, the famous, you know, the night that Sutton went on, and like, you know.
I wasn't.
Wasn't Kristen a part of it too at one point?
I wasn't a part of that. Although I have to say, I've known Dick Scanlon since
the book writer.
Pageant. Yeah. Dick Scanlon wrote the book for Millie. He was in Pageant as an actor back in the early 90s.
Wow.
Whom James Raitt had done all the arrangements for Pageant, as well as done all the arrangements for Forever Plaid, and both were sort of small hits at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And James and I became very close. He was one of my first mentors, and that's how I met Dick. But I'd kept in touch with Dick over through the years, and I remember when he invited me down to 890 to see the first staged reading of Thoroughly Modern Millie.
Oh, cool.
Which was really nothing more than the script of the movie and the songs just thrown up on stage. Mm-hmm. Edward Hibbert as Mrs. Mears.
What?
Oh, my gosh.
Christine Ebersole as Muzzy. And she still said raspberries, like that's how that like
raspberries.
They literally followed the she literally followed the script of the movie.
Oh my God.
Screenplay.
Oh my God.
Amanda Naughton as Millie, Krista Moore as Miss Dorothy.
Oh my God.
Jimmy Ludwig, who's still out there.
His show just
closed before rehearsals. I need to know more about that. He was supposed to start rehearsals for a show and it just closed.
I don't know.
Or they've just canceled. Anyway, I'm sorry, Jimmy, if you're listening. But you're good and something new will come up immediately. But he was Jimmy, and Alan Morocco was... they hadn't decided to call those two guys Bun Fu and Ching Ho yet. But... but they were the laundry guys. And it was just so much fun. And
right.
I knew that there was... Even though it was the film version, which is so... Talk about weird. It's a weird movie.
It's very weird.
It is bizarre.
But that's where it started. And Stacia Fernandez was Ethel Pease, who gets kidnapped in the very beginning.
Right.
So I remember this because I keep everything. Yeah. I still have the little piece of paper from 890. But that was the start of something. And Dick had just gotten permission to do it. And
so it was
cut
pre-Tesori songs.
Pre-Tesori, yeah. Yep.
Wow.
And then Janine came on later on. And I didn't audition for it again till pre-La Jolla. Mm-hmm. Mm. But then the role went to Jim Stanek.
Oh, yeah. Right.
And Aaron Dilley. Yeah. So they were heading the cast. Pat Carroll, I think, was in the cast as well. Wow. I could be totally mixing up all my stories, but you'll hear from people. and then what happened in La Jolla is what happened. And Sutton took over, and it came to New York. I didn't audition for it again in New York until after the first year, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. In fact, here comes back to Joey Sorge, who was opposite me in Follies. Mm-hmm. He was in the ensemble covering Jimmy Smith, going on quite a bit, covering Trevor Graydon as well. They were offering him Jimmy on the national tour, and he said, hey, you know, I know you need a job, and this is an easy understudy track. They'll love you. You'll love it. And at that point, I'd done a couple of workshops with Michael Rafter of the show. He was putting together of Swing Show. Shift. He and David Armstrong of the Fifth Avenue Theater were putting together this musical version of Swing Shift using period music, period tunes, mm-hmm. and cleverly woven into this story. So between that, getting to know Michael, and I came in to audition, and yeah, I got to be back on Broadway, what was not to love about Thoroughly Modern Millie? It had such a Golden Age / pre-Golden Age feel about it, slapstick, silly, screwball, and good songs, and a good script. I mean, if you're going to take a movie musical and bring it to the stage, I think that's the way to do it.
Right.
It was Dick really knew how to get to the story, still keep it silly, still keep it lovable.
He towed the line pretty well. Like, yeah.
Yeah.
It's not too campy, but it is. It has to be.
Oh, it has to be. And
but it's still like a throwback.
We closed it in July of 2004. And seriously, I don't know about now, but I think for a while I was saying, if the show had kept running, I would have stayed. I would have stayed until they tore the theater down. Yeah. It was so much fun to do. Again, another backstage that was a thrill to be a part of.
Yeah.
And just fun people. You know, I got to work with Delta Burke, who was just fun.
That's cool.
She's fun. I mean, she's out there, and she'll tell you she's out there, but she was fun. And then replaced by the sweet and lovable Dixie Carter.
Oh, right. Wow, they went right from one to the other.
I was like, when's Annie Potts coming in? Gene Smart. And you know, Leslie Uggams, come on, who doesn't want to share the stage with Leslie?
Totally.
Another like Broadway treasure.
Yeah.
You know? And I made some great friends out of that run. And you know, watching Sutton work that hard every night and keeping it fresh. We all know why she is where she is and how she got there, but I got to just watch her every night, and it was such a thrill just to watch the most minute moments for her just still matter to her. And it just never, it whether she was feeling shitty on the inside or I remember she did jury duty for 8 weeks, and she missed every Wednesday matinee for 8 weeks because she was in jury duty. And
she was on a jury?
Yeah.
I did not know.
Yeah, and she still came in and just kicked that show out of the park every night. And, you know, another opportunity that I had just to, and that, it's just great. It was a great thing. And my dad was one of the last things it was the last Broadway show he saw me do.
You've worked with some real legends, you being included in that as well. What makes a good actor? In the room, what do you think makes a good actor?
I don't know that I have anything new to say about it, but I think what makes a good actor in the room is just be focused, be kind, be focused, know your shit. If you don't have to be off book for that first rehearsal, I don't think that's what people look for. I don't. You gotta have something to write down on. But kindness, and you know, I'm not saying you know, don't bring treats, don't bring, you know, but be kind and respectful. I've seen too many people injure each other because they're not respectful of that person's process. And I know I'm trying not to use so many actor terms, but if somebody works at a different pace than you, don't blame them because you want to work faster or you want to work slower. Take a breath. Let it happen. It's all going to come together. Everybody's going to be ready on opening night. I just think there are certain... I think what gets in... I'm sorry. I'm answering your question from the other side of
That's
it.
Great.
I'm going towards the negative. But it's such an impediment when... actors lose patience with each other, when directors lose patience with actors, or vice versa. And there is a time to lose patience. There is. It's not in the room in front of everybody. It's right. not. It's not acting out in front of anybody else. But it's taking that time afterwards or before when nobody else is, just to ask what's going on, how can we help and fix. But I think what helps make these, what makes people legends and what makes them good is that it's kindness, it's respect, it's talent, and you can't buy the talent, you could argue whether or not talent is learned. I think it's cultivated, but can you teach talent? I don't know. I think you can teach the craft, and then the art is whatever you can do to it.
So would you say that you're primarily a director right now?
Yeah.
I mean, is there anything that'll ever get you back on that stage? Are there any roles that you're still dying to play?
I don't think 20 people would come to see it, but if the Weislers called and said, we need a Billy Flynn for 2 weeks coming to do it, stuff like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. That would be fun. But I'm very lucky to have done everything I wanted to do as an actor.
That's wonderful.
Yeah. I did. I got to star on Broadway. I got to cover on Broadway. I got to tap dance on Broadway.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I never thought I'd never aced that opening number in 42nd Street. I could never tap that well.
Mm-hmm.
But I got to do
I
could do my tap number in Millie. I did a soap for a couple of years. I did commercials. I did voiceovers. I did recordings. I always felt like, I think Millie is really where I felt like, eight a week. I love the show, and I still would have done it for another 2 or 3 years, but I think that would have been my last or next to last time. I did go back to the Fantastics for a little while, but that's sort of like visiting. That's like putting on an old shoe, and I mean that in a good way.
Very
comfortable old shoe.
But I went back, and I covered at Fantastics for a while because I'd played the boy down at the Sullivan Street Playhouse. Mm-hmm. And then all too soon, when the show opened up in at Snapple, they're like, we need you for Elgayo. I was like,
you're like,
fuck
Elgayo?
Oh, God, what? No, it's when the father call came in. I was like, really?
So,
oh, come on.
So now I have played the mute, the boy, the boy's father, the girl's father, and Elgayo.
That's incredible.
That's awesome.
I played the girl's father opposite the actor who played my father down at the Sullivan Street Playhouse, Gene Jones. And just the look in his face, just his little glint in his eye, just going,
mm-hmm.
You don't belong in that costume. You don't, no, no.
Jones and Schmidt really don't get the credit that they deserve, I don't think.
Nope.
I don't think they get nearly enough credit.
Yeah.
No. 110 in the Shade? Come on, please.
Oh, my God. Well, that was your...
That was my thesis production.
That was your thesis
at Penn State.
Nice.
Yeah, when I was getting my MFA. I say it like I got it like 30 years ago.
No.
I just got it last month.
So you got your MFA in directing for musical theater specifically.
Yes,
right?
Which same is degree you have.
Same degree that I have.
Yeah.
I did not do 110 in the Shade as my thesis, though.
What was yours?
Mine was Man of No Importance.
Yes, that poster still hung in our office.
Oh, is it really?
Yep. Yep.
What's next for you?
I want, you know, I really dug this academic thing. So I'm hoping for a gig at a school, particularly a school that embraces musical theater as a viable art form. Many of them do now. They're cropping up all over. And programs that had usually non-musical theater a curriculum are adding these specialty degrees to their programs.
Yeah.
I think they're being very wise. They see the financial benefit of doing it, but it happens every now and then, but still look at what Hamilton has done for justifying how good a storytelling venue in musical theater can be. So that's my hope. I really want to teach not only am I a practitioner in the studio and on the stage, but I also consider myself a bit of a musical theater historian. So there's a lot I can offer to a curriculum like that. So we're looking around. My next gig, however, I'm just going to be a good old director. I'm going down to University of West Florida to direct their Christmas Carol production.
Nice.
They wanted a fresh take on it. So I'm looking forward to it. It's a really good script, actually. It was a script that was written for the Alley, commissioned by the Alley Theater about 10 years ago.
Oh, great.
It's good. It's good. It's non-musical, which is kind of fun. I don't know that, and I don't mean to upset anybody, I don't know that Christmas Carol needs to be musical. It's elevated enough.
Mm-hmm.
True.
Know? So I get to work my magic. You know, I like chairs and benches.
Yeah. Keep
awesome.
It simple. You are absolutely wonderful. Thank you so much for joining us both today.
Sharing with us your family.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks. Go look up Dad's commercials.
I'm
They're fun.
Totally going to do that.
You know what? We didn't ask you. When you were auditioning, what was your audition song? What was your go-to?
Other than Out There.
Besides Out There. What was the Rich Roland go-to?
Special.
I used Once Upon a Time Today from Call Me Madam.
What?
That was a big one for me.
Good one.
I mean, you know, I think it's hard to have a go-to because one day you're auditioning for, let's say, Call Me Madam, and the next day you're auditioning for Miss Saigon, you know, and it's got to be so specific. But I'll tell you, when it came to those categories, my Golden Age ballad was Once Upon a Time Today. My pop Macintosh, whatever it was going to be, was until before it was out there from Hunchback, it was So Beyond.
Oh, right. Marilyn. Yes, of course.
My God.
That was like the classic, like, male, like, belt to your face off.
What was it called? So Beyond?
So Beyond. Joe DiMaggio sings it.
Willie Falk did it. That was Willie Falk, the guy. Oh, my God.
He would
be the Chris in the...
Yeah.
And Miss Saigon.
Well, that's why I sang it, because nobody wanted to hear Why God Why anymore.
Yeah.
That's a brilliant idea. So Beyond, and we got the Call Me Madam song. What is yours? I never asked you, Kevin.
I don't know anymore. I used to do Out There. That's why I did Les Mis. That's what got me Les Mis. Mm-hmm. I do more classical music theater, so I do like Speak Low, Kurt Weill.
Oh, yeah.
I'm trying to think. The song from Goldilocks, I Can't Be in Love. I arranged the Don Ameche song from Goldilocks
because
I love
really?
Goldilocks so much.
Wow. Yeah. Okay.
Good response on that.
Okay. Yeah, anyway. Like, well, maybe we'll have a concert with you guys. We can all
obscure
our audition book and go.
Oh, I also used I'm Getting Myself Ready for You, Cole Porter. I don't know if you know that one.
Yeah.
Nobody really knew that one for a while. So
that's charming.
You know, I was using Michael Levine a lot as a reference because I would just say, Michael, I can't sing the next. So he gave me a nice rundown of pieces.
He's got a couple songs in his
collection. He's got a couple. He knows a little bit.
He's a little bit. You have been absolutely wonderful.
Thank you. What fun this was.
We cannot wait to see what happens next for you.
Me too.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.